Hello, everyone. This is Joan with today's reading of the Washington Post. And today is February 19th. 8 skiers found dead as search continues after California avalanche. It surpasses a total of 7 killed in a March 1982 avalanche at the Alpine Meadows, now Palisades Tahoe Ski Resort, in the same general region. 8 Back County skiers were found dead on Wednesday as a significant rescue effort continues for one still missing near Tucci, California, following an avalanche in the area the day before, according to the Nevada County Sheriff's Office. With 8 people confirmed killed by the massive snow slide, described as the length of a football field, it is now the deadliest avalanche in modern California history. It surpasses the total of 7 killed in a March 1982 avalanche at the Alpine Meadows, now Palisades Tahoe Ski Resort, in the same general region. In an early email to the Washington Post, Leslie Williams of the Nevada County Sheriff's Office confirmed that 6 survivors from a 15-person group had been located and were being transported by rescue teams to receive medical care. But conditions continue to be a challenge for rescuers. There is limited access to the area affected by the avalanche, Williams said. Officials initially believed there were 16 people in the skiing group, but that number was later revised to reflect 15 people who actually went on the trip, the sheriff's office said in an update late Tuesday, local time. At their Wednesday morning news conference, the office reported there were 9 women and 6 men in the group. Captain Rusty Green of the Nevada County Sheriff's Department said the bodies of the skiers have not been removed due to ongoing bad weather and additional avalanche threats. The longer that we continue to have people out there and exposed, the higher chance we put our rescuers in danger, Green said. At least 46 emergency first responders were involved in the rescue effort in the Castle Peak area of Truckee, around 10 miles north of Lake Tahoe. In a statement Tuesday, Blackbird Mountain Guides, a touring company that organizes backcountry expeditions, said the ski group included 12 clients and 4 guides. The group was in the process of returning to the trailhead at the conclusion of a 3-day trip when the incident occurred, it said. In a subsequent update, the company said it was fully engaged in assisting with any rescue efforts. The West is being hit by a barrage of powerful storms, with snow forecast to continue around Truckee through Thursday night, and total snowfall reaching several feet across the Sierra Nevada in coming days. Winter storm and avalanche warnings were in effect for Truckee on Tuesday, with snow amounts of up to 4 feet and wind gusts up to 100 miles per hour. Rapidly accumulating snowfall, weak layers in the existing snowpack, and gale-force winds that blow and drift snow have created dangerous avalanche conditions in the mountains, read the avalanche warning. Natural avalanches are likely, and human-triggered avalanches large enough to bury or injure people are very likely. Nevada County authorities also warned conditions remain highly dangerous, with large avalanches expected to occur Tuesday night, and into at least early Wednesday morning, across back county terrain. The Sierra Avalanche Center also extended prior alerts for the Tahoe region, now under an avalanche warning, through Thursday morning. Climate scientist Daniel Swain said there were 2 factors that led to Tuesday's very high risk of avalanches. Dry and record warm weather in recent weeks, causing a weak snow base, and high snow rates during the current storm. The weather station at Truckee reported heavy snow on Tuesday for 8 consecutive hours, with visibility dropping as low as 1/8 of a mile. The temperature had dropped into the low 20s on Tuesday night, with a wind chill in the mid-teens and winds gusting to around 20 miles per hour. In a post on X, Colin McCarthy, a storm chaser associated with the University of California at Davis, wrote that, "These are the worst blizzard conditions I have seen in my life at Donna Summit, California, west of Truckee." The State Highway Agency said in a post late Tuesday it closed Interstate 80 in both directions over the Donna Summit because of whiteout conditions. Donna doesn't care about your schedule. We'll reopen when it's safe, not before, wrote the California Highway Patrol in Truckee. While snow will continue through Wednesday, its intensity is less severe than on Tuesday. Still, blustery conditions will lead to considerable blowing and drifting snow, as life-threatening conditions continue across the Sierra Nevada. A bigger burst of snow is expected on Thursday, with another foot or more in the forecast for the Sierra Back County. Bowser declares Potomac sewerage spill an emergency. Seeks federal aid for cleanup. D.C. Mayor Muriel E. Bowser, Democrat, declared the Potomac River sewerage spill a public emergency Wednesday and requested federal assistance with cleanup as the Trump administration continued to criticize local leaders for allegedly mishandling the environmental disaster. Bowser also requested a presidential disaster declaration, and she asked the federal government to reimburse the D.C. government and D.C. Water for all costs associated with the spill and recovery effort. This is the best way to ensure that we have the full weight of resources that, quite frankly, the residents deserve, Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice Lindsay Appiah said in a news conference. The spill began in mid-January when part of a major D.C. water storage pipeline called the Potomac Interceptor collapsed, flooding the Potomac River with about 234 million gallons of wastewater. The sewer line carries about 60 million gallons of wastewater daily from the Virginia and Maryland suburbs to D.C. for treatment. The cause of the collapse is still under investigation. Officials with D.C. Water, the public utility responsible for water and sewerage in the region, have said drinking water remains safe to drink. But officials have issued warnings for people and pests to stay out of the water near the spill site and downstream in D.C. The moves by Bowser come as President Donald Trump has insulted local leaders in recent days for allegedly mishandling the spill. In a Truth Social post Tuesday, Trump said D.C., Maryland, and Virginia officials must get to work immediately to address the sewage spill. If they can't do the job, they have to call me and ask politely to get it fixed, he said. Trump has directed much of his ire at Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Democrat, saying he's not doing the job. Moore has said Maryland officials responded quickly after the leak and said the Environmental Protection Agency refused to participate in a hearing last week on the cleanup. Maryland Republicans also tried to lean on Moore to accept federal help. State Delegate Matthew Morgan, Republican of St. Mary's, wrote in a social media post Wednesday, if the EPA has offered full support from the start and you haven't asked them to take the lead, what are you waiting for? Raw human sewage is spilling into the Potomac. The spill occurred at a confluence of federal and local jurisdiction. D.C. Water, which serves residents in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, controls the pipeline that collapsed. The sewage flowed into Maryland waters before going downstream into the district. Federal land operated by the National Park Service surrounds the spill site. Earlier Wednesday, D.C. Water CEO David L. Gaddis and members of his leadership team visited the White House to meet with officials there. It is my understanding the district government, EPA, FEMA, and other agencies were represented as well, D.C. Water spokesperson John Lyle said in an email. The sewage spill also was a topic during an afternoon briefing with White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, who advised leaders in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. to make a formal request to the president so that he declares an emergency. That's part of the legal process to move forward, Leavitt said. Bowers' request to Trump came hours later. Appiah said Wednesday evening that the mayor's declaration and request was D.C.'s path towards securing more resources for recovery from the spill and better coordinating the various local and federal agencies with jurisdiction over the river and spill site. D.C. Water activated an emergency bypass system within about a week of the spill, but full repairs to the pipeline and other recovery efforts will take much longer. The vast majority of the wastewater from the spill, all but 1.5 million gallons, entered the river between January 19th and January 28th, as that bypass system was being set up, according to D.C. water officials. The pipeline is about 60 years old and was targeted for repairs well before the spill. A fix at the very site that collapsed had been scheduled for this summer, D.C. water officials said. Lyle said the emergency response to construct the bypass system, prepare the canal, do excavation work, and repair the pipe is expected to cost about $10 million. He said those costs would be allocated between the different uses of the pipe. When asked this week, officials at the utility declined to specify whether residents in the region would see their water bills increase to pay for the recovery efforts. Bowser wrote in her letter to Trump that she was seeking to avoid such rate hikes, asking for 100% reimbursement, such that emergency response, repair, and remediation costs are not incurred by ratepayers in any impacted state or the district. D.C. is calling for regular interagency coordination calls between the various federal, state, and local entities involved in the repair and recovery effort. Appiah also said Wednesday that the district was hoping federal assistance could help the city's environmental department test water quality in the river more frequently. The department has been testing weekly, but hopes to test daily, she said. Initial testing after the spill revealed high levels of E. coli and Staphylococcus aureus, the bacteria that causes staph infections, in water near where the pipeline burst, according to scientists from the University of Maryland and researchers with the Potomac Riverkeeper Network. E. coli levels were found to be more than 10,000 times above EPA recreational water quality standards. Testing in recent days has shown E. coli levels meeting recreational standards downstream in D.C., though city officials still advise residents to avoid touching the river, as those numbers could fluctuate. D.C. officials are also requesting longer-term federal funding and assistance with drinking water projects. And with D.C.'s Water's Clean Rivers Project, an ongoing and massive effort that aims to reduce sewer overflows into local waterways. Each year, rainwater brings hundreds of millions of gallons of combined sewer overflows into the city's rivers. With additional tunnel construction and other efforts, D.C. Water still hopes to make the Potomac safe for swimming by 2030. We've been asking for the Environmental Protection Agency to step up and show some leadership on this issue and hold D.C. Water accountable, said Potomac Riverkeeper Dean Nojuk. If this comes from that, then that's a good thing. I also think it's going to lead to more federal dollars for the Potomac River, and that's a good thing too. Trump officials limit FEMA travel to disaster areas amid funding lapse, emails show. The Department of Homeland Security has halted almost all travel amid the ongoing standoff over its funding, restricting the ability of hundreds of federal emergency management agency staff members to move in and out of disaster-affected areas, according to emails and documents obtained by the Washington Post. Much of the department ran out of money over the weekend after negotiations stalled between the White House and Democratic lawmakers over restrictions on federal immigration enforcement. It is normal for the department to stop employees from traveling across the country for various assignments, such as trainings during a funding lapse, 10 current and former FEMA officials said. But it is unusual for a government shutdown to impede ongoing disaster recovery efforts, the officials explained, saying it further reflects sweeping policies instituted under Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem. Typically, FEMA staffers who work on disasters are able to travel to and from ongoing recovery projects regardless of DHS funding issues. And a current veteran official said that disaster travel is always allowed because it is mission critical. In a statement, DHS criticized Democratic lawmakers over the stalled funding negotiations, and said the department and FEMA are coordinating closely to ensure effective disaster response under these circumstances. During a funding lapse, FEMA prioritizes life safety and property protection. FEMA continues mission essential operations for active disasters, including immediate response and critical survivor assistance. FEMA spokesperson Daniel Lagares said in a statement. While some non-essential activities will be paused or scaled back, FEMA remains committed to supporting communities and responding to incidents like Hurricane Helene. Congressional Democrats have demanded new restrictions on federal immigration agents after federal personnel killed Alex Preddy and another U.S. citizen, Renee Good, in Minneapolis in January. On Tuesday night, DHS sent out an email ordering a stop to all travel, including for disaster-related work, sparking confusion across FEMA as teams continue to respond to 14 ongoing disaster declarations as a result of brutal winter storms that hit parts of the country last month. In another message obtained by the Post, a FEMA official said that all travel stopped and noted that 360 people who were slated to go to trainings and other assignments had to stand down. People who were supposed to deploy could begin work virtually, but DHS now had to sign off on their in-person assignment, the message said. The next morning, officials within DHS and FEMA had to scramble and negotiate guidance for how disaster-specific workers could continue to travel, according to an official familiar with the situation. In most cases, FEMA's ability to deploy staff to active disaster response and recovery operations is not impacted by a DHS funding lapse, said former FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell. Those personnel are funded through the Staffing Act Disaster Relief Fund, which is specifically designed to ensure continuity of operations during emergencies. If DHS experiences a shutdown, FEMA employees supported by the Disaster Relief Fund should still be able to travel and carry out response missions. Emails and documents obtained by the Post show that FEMA officials must submit a justification to DHS headquarters explaining why a staffer needs to travel during the funding lapse, including employees who are paid through the Disaster Relief Fund. Officials also have to state whether the travel is mission essential, meaning it involves the safety of human life, or protection of property. DHS imposing restrictions on FEMA's ability to deploy your response recovery workforce slows us down and limits our ability to respond quickly and effectively to the needs of an impacted state and communities, said one official in the region, still cleaning up from the heavy onslaught of sleet and snow. According to one email sent Tuesday night, agency staff members currently deployed in another region that was hit particularly hard can continue assisting communities. But those who were slated to travel to these locations after Thursday can no longer do so. Employees who were on a rotation, perhaps home for a week to see family or go to the doctor, are not able to return to their job under the order. Those rotations are critical to disaster work because they enable people who have been working nonstop to take a break and then come back to their work. FEMA is also required to relieve employees who have been working too long in a state where they do not live. In the email, FEMA staff members who had not yet begun their deployments or returns from rotation were directed to cancel their travel and notify their point of contact to receive updated reporting instructions. Additional agency-wide information will be forthcoming, it read. The snag with some FEMA employees being unable to travel for disaster work, take breaks, or relieve their colleagues add to the beleaguered agency's long list of operational issues since President Donald Trump took office for a second time and his appointees implemented significant changes on how the agency functions. The travel pause has also halted some of FEMA's other critical work, such as leading exercises and assessments for emergency plans and procedures at nuclear facilities, and flood mapping meetings with communities, according to an email obtained by the Post and an agency official familiar with the situation. That will delay flood map updates, which directly impacts people waiting on new maps for any number of reasons, the official said. As the winter storms barreled in last month, Nome, who has been spearheading many of FEMA's staffing reductions and reforms, was particularly hands-on, embedding at the agency's headquarters, hosting a call with governors to show her support, and holding news conferences with FEMA staff members in front of maps, laying out where the weather would hit. DHS also prepositioned teams, millions of ready-made meals and liters of water, blankets, and hundreds of generators in several states that were expected to be slammed, a practice that FEMA usually follows before most major storms. That's why instituting travel restrictions when staffers are still working on these storm responses is even more frustrating, several current employees said. They are just trying to make it hurt, and the only people they are hurting are survivors and FEMA employees, one veteran official said. They just pull new rules out every day. GOP congressman who says he supports dogs over Muslims faces calls to resign. Democrats are demanding that Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, resign or face disciplinary action after making an anti-Muslim social media post in which he suggested that he would choose dogs over Muslims. If they force us to choose, the choice between dogs and Muslims is not a difficult one, Fine said in a post Sunday on X, which he wrote in response to comments by a leader of a pro-Palestinian group about dog owners not cleaning up after their pets on New York City streets. Fine defended his comments during a television interview Tuesday. In response, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, said Tuesday that Fine is an Islamophobic, disgusting, and unrepentant bigot. Jeffries said it is unacceptable that House Speaker Mike Johnson, Louisiana, and other House Republicans have not forcefully criticized Fine, who has history in his short tenure in Congress of making Islamophobic comments. Fine needs to be held accountable, Jeffries said. Jeffries said House Democrats will not let the racist and bigoted behavior of Randy Fine go unchecked and suggested the party could take disciplinary action if it wins control of the chamber in the November midterms, if not sooner. Several House Democrats have called for Fine to resign or be disciplined by Republicans who currently hold a narrow majority in the House. This is generally one of the most disgusting statements I have ever seen issued by an American official, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, said on X. It should not stop shocking us that the Republican Party openly embraces this. Fine should be censured and stripped of committees. To ignore this is to accept and normalize it. Spokespeople for Johnson did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Fine's remarks and Democratic demands to discipline him. Fine made his initial post in response to a comment made by activist Nurdin Kiswani, who on February 12th said on X that New York City was coming to Islam because many New Yorkers were complaining about how dog owners were not cleaning up after their pets and leaving dog poop all over the sidewalks. Dogs definitely have a place in society, just not as indoor pets, Kiswani said February 12th. Like we've said all along, they are unclean. Kiswani, who co-founded the pro-Palestinian group Within Our Lifetime, said on the same X thread that she was joking. It's obviously a joke, Kiswani said on X about her original post. I don't care if you have a dog. I do care if your dog is pooping everywhere and you're not cleaning it. In an interview with the Washington Post on Tuesday, Kiswani said that she was really shocked by the reaction her post drew, saying that her comments were just part of a local New York City discourse. Kiswani noted that outlets such as the New York Post have written about New Yorkers' complaints about the uptick in dog poop being left behind. A lot of people, including city council members, were just criticizing people bringing dogs into grocery stores and stuff like that, she said. So, you know, I made a quick joke about it. Fine, resigning, Kiswani said, is the bare minimum. Censuring is not enough, she said, adding that Democrats should match their actions with their words and not just make this call on Twitter. Kiswani's explanation on X appeared not to sway Fine, who said in an interview with Newsmax that his post was in response to a major Muslim leader saying dogs should be forbidden from New York City because to some Muslims, it bothers them. Well, if they're going to make us choose between our dogs and them going home, the choice is easy, Fine said, doubling down. Fine, who arrived in Congress last year after winning a special election, has drawn criticism for other anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian comments. In July, he said Gazans should starve away until Israeli hostages were released. In December, Fine called for the mass expulsion of Muslims from the United States. It is time for a Muslim travel ban, radical deportations of all mainstream Muslim legal and illegal immigrants, and citizenship revocations whenever possible, Fine posted on social media at the time. Mainstream Muslims have declared war on us. The least we can do is kick them the hell out of America. Union membership edged up in 2025 despite attacks from Trump administration. The share of American workers in unions edged up in 2025, the first rise in years despite the Trump administration's attacks on federal government unions and the agency that enforces collective bargaining rights. Union membership increased by a tenth of a percentage point to 10% last year because of successes in union organizing and slower labor market growth. About 14.7 million workers were union members in 2025, an increase of 410,000, according to data released by the Labor Department on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the number of workers represented by unions rose to the highest level since 2009. That figure, which represents workers covered by union contracts generally, is higher than union membership numbers, because some workers opt out of membership in unionized workplaces, even though they receive the benefits of a union contract. Last year's union gains coincided with numerous actions by the Trump administration aimed at weakening organized labor's power. President Donald Trump stripped millions of federal workers of their collective bargaining rights and canceled federal union contracts. He also fired a member of the National Labor Relations Board without cause for the first time in the agency's 90-year history. For most of the year, the board lacked a quorum necessary to consider cases alleging violations of the National Labor Relations Act. Despite the attacks on the federal government unions, union membership in the public sector grew in 2025 and continued to be about five times higher than the private sector at 32.9%. That boost came in part from a rise in union membership in the federal government, as tens of thousands of civil servants joined unions amid attacks on their jobs from the Trump administration. Even in our current broken system of labor law and policy, we're seeing this increase in union density, said Celine McNicholas, Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute. It's clear that workers want union and are winning unions. Healthcare, retail, education, and construction also posted strong gains in union membership. Meanwhile, some traditional blue-collar industries, including manufacturing, mining, and transportation, saw declines in union membership. Among major racial groups, black workers continued to have the highest rates of union membership in 2025, at 11.4%, compared to 9.9% for white workers. Union membership had hit an all-time low in 2023 and again in 2024, despite efforts by President Joe Biden to expand union workers' power. That's partly because millions of non-union jobs were created coming out of the pandemic as the economy reopened. But in 2025, the labor market grew at its slowest pace outside of recessions since the early 2000s. Declines in union membership across the United States have been attributed to the shift toward a service-based economy, the influx of right-to-work laws, and employer opposition to unions. Support for unions have soared over the past decade and was at 68% in 2025, near levels not seen since the 1960s, according to Gallup polling. Democratic-led cities moved to block ICE, setting up clash with Trump. Elected Democrats in major U.S. cities have banded together to try to block the Trump administration from aggressive immigration operations, such as the one now winding down in Minneapolis, issuing a slate of policy changes and vowing to prosecute agents who violate local laws. Over the past 2 weeks, mayors in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Boston, Oakland, and Seattle have signed executive orders attempting to restrict how and where immigration and customs enforcement agents can operate in their cities. The policies broadly seek to restrict ICE agents from city property and parks, and in some cases, direct local police to monitor the activities of federal agents. In a corresponding move, a group of about a dozen local prosecutors is warning that ICE agents will be prosecuted under local law if they commit a crime while carrying out their duties to detain undocumented immigrants. The group, led by Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, Democrat, vows such prosecutions could occur even after President Donald Trump is out of office. Appeasers fail, and people fight back when they are up against an enemy of this nature, Krasner said in an interview. And these are the enemies of the United States of America, because these people are profoundly and fundamentally anti-equality and anti-American. The efforts, coordinated by civil rights and Democratic-aligned groups, represent a new phase in the building battle between Trump and local elected officials, who are worried their city will be the next targeted by the federal government for aggressive enforcement of immigration laws. On Tuesday, Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Democrat, signed legislation making Maryland the latest state to prohibit local law enforcement from formal cooperation with federal authorities on immigration arrests. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to requests for comment for this article. Over the past year, Trump has deployed National Guard troops to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., while also sending large numbers of ICE and Border Patrol agents to those cities, Chicago, Portland, and Minneapolis. White House Border Czar Tom Homan last week announced the end of the surge in Minneapolis, where two U.S. citizens, Renee Good and Alex Pretty, were killed by federal personnel. The deaths have eroded public support for Trump's immigration crackdown and galvanized local leaders over how they can try to fortify their cities against ICE operations. Legal experts said the growing divide between federal and local leaders raises complex questions about federalism, qualified immunity, and the 10th Amendment, which says that powers not delegated to the federal government belong to the states. While we are not on unprecedented ground, we're certainly on historically unusual ground, said Cesar Garcia Hernandez, a law professor at Ohio State University who studies immigration policy. There are just lots of unanswered questions. Many of the newly issued executive orders include regulations banning federal agents from wearing masks and prohibiting them from using any city-owned property to carry out their operations. New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani, Democrat, prohibited non-city law enforcement agencies from using city-owned property, including parking lots, as staging areas, processing locations, or operations bases. In a city where parks make up 14% of the land, the policy could have vast implications for how federal agencies would operate. The city has control over its property, said Bida Mostafi, a top advisor to Mamdani on immigration-related matters. It's making it really clear that while there is a delineation of authorities, we are making very clear where we have authority. We are taking action, and property is an example of that. Mamdani has also stressed that New York's efforts to form a barrier around its citizens will continue to expand. Last week, he hosted Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, Democrat, to discuss additional steps cities should take to push back against ICE. Mamdani said he is building relationships with mayors across the country to learn from other cities and from what we can share from the lessons of our own. As they attempt to coordinate, mayors are being helpful by a network of outside groups. The Public Rights Project is working with dozens of cities on how to draft immigration-related bills and executive orders so that they withstand federal or legal scrutiny, said founder Jill Habig. Part of the power that local governments are using really derives from the 10th Amendment, Habig said. Cities cannot obstruct the federal government from enforcing the law, but they do not have to use or divert city resources to help and aid in that enforcement. Habig accused the Trump administration of trying to override the checks and balances in the U.S. Constitution. A new group, Mayors for America, is working with mayors on model legislation on how to message their policies to the broader public. The group is led by Julie Chavez Rodriguez, a former senior advisor to President Joe Biden and campaign manager for Vice President Kamala Harris's 2024 presidential campaign. Mayors are going to continue to stand firm in their authorities and their leadership as executives in their cities and as stewards of our democracy, Rodriguez said. But Hernandez, the Ohio State law professor, said there are limits on how far cities can go in attempting to impact the behavior of federal agents. Local officials have the power to regulate how public parks are used, he said, but probably cannot deny ICE agents from accessing spaces that are broadly open to the public. The more a place is open to the public, the less a local government has a legal right to keep people out, especially if targeting a particular group of people, Hernandez said. The federal government and immigration offices do have the right to go into public spaces when they suspect that people are present who are violating federal law. Hernandez also expects legal challenges should Krasner, the Philadelphia district attorney, follow through with bringing charges against ICE agents who allegedly violate state or local law. About a dozen top prosecutors have joined Krasner in making that pledge, including those in Austin, Dallas, Tucson, and in Fairfax and Arlington counties in Virginia. Although Hernandez said federal agents don't have unlimited authority to whatever they want on the job, they can still use reasonable force to carry out their jobs. He said case law about local prosecutions of federal personnel dates back to at least 1906, when the U.S. Supreme Court allowed Pennsylvania authorities to prosecute two U.S. Army soldiers for killing a man they caught stealing copper. On other local laws, such as banning ICE agents from wearing masks, Hernandez said federal authorities generally are not immune from having to follow state and local laws. But Hernandez suspects a court would strike down laws that appear too narrowly drafted. The more specific a law is, the more it looks like discrimination against particular government entities arising from a disagreement over policy, Hernandez said. Krasner said he has fallen to local prosecutors to protect the civil rights of citizens and residents targeted by ICE, taking on a role that the federal government has historically held since the Civil War. There is not a lot of precedent for this because it's always been the feds who protect us from rogue criminal law enforcement, Krasner said. Now the script has been flipped, where there are the southern sheriffs and we are the feds. Most prosecutors would not waste resources targeting ICE personnel for relatively minor crimes, Krasner said. But he added that such violations could become evidence during the scope of broader investigations. If there is a brutal beating, an aggravated assault, we're going to bring that, Krasner said. And if you are trying to conceal your identity and run away from the scene, things like that have consequences in court when juries are constructing the inferences that they can draw from such behavior. Trump has repeatedly attacked Philadelphia and other major U.S. cities as overrun with crime, even though violent crime rates have fallen sharply in recent years. He accuses local Democratic officials of refusing to cooperate with immigration enforcement, even though that enforcement has historically been the responsibility of the federal government. Trump also has suggested that Philadelphia could be next in line for a federal law enforcement surge. In response, in late January, two members of the Philadelphia City Council, Democrat Lou Landau and Kendra Brooks of the Working Families Party, introduced broad ICE-out legislation that would ban law enforcement officials from wearing masks or using unmarked vehicles, while also prohibiting employees from granting ICE agents access to city-owned spaces. Brooks said the legislation, co-sponsored by 15 of 17 council members, sent a message to the Trump administration that it will not have an easy time should it deploy large numbers of ICE agents to Philadelphia. She and other council members are also taking the lead in holding ICE watcher trainings, where civilians learn how to record and monitor federal immigration officials. So far, more than 1,400 city residents have attended. Philly takes care of Philly, Landau said. We are gritty, and we are very protective of each other. Talks break in Geneva with no end to Russia's war or hardline demands. U.S. mediated talks between Moscow and Kyiv in Geneva broke off on Wednesday without any significant progress or indication that Russia was ready to step back from its maximalist demands for subjugating Ukraine. The head of the Russian delegation, Vladimir Medinsky, tersely said the talks had been difficult but businesslike and had ended after just 2 hours of discussions on Wednesday, following longer conversations the previous day. The reappearance of Medinsky, known to be a hardline aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin, as head of the Kremlin delegation, had signified that Russia was digging in its heels on core demands, including significant cuts to the Ukrainian military, the dismantling of Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky's government, and guarantees for Ukraine's neutrality, analysts said. Moscow has insisted that these steps are required to address what it describes as the root causes of the war. Ukraine's position is that Russia's invasion was unprovoked, and that Moscow should end its illegal war of aggression and remove its troops that are occupying Ukrainian territory. Russian analysts said Moscow's demands encompassed a far wider spectrum of issues than the territorial swaps proposed by President Donald Trump's administration as a path to end the war. As long as there is an armed anti-Russia on Ukrainian territory, there can be no peace, said Sergei Markov, a pro-Kremlin political analyst. I don't think anyone had any big hopes that the talks would end in success. The positions are very, very far from each other. The idea of territorial swaps for peace is not Russia's idea, Markov said. It is Trump's. Proponents of territorial exchanges envision that Russia would withdraw from some areas it occupies in Ukraine in exchange for Ukraine withdrawing its military from parts of the heavily fortified Donbass area, which Putin has failed to capture during 4 years of full-scale war. Zelensky's administration has previously said it could agree to withdraw troops from the Donbass area. But Kyiv has said it would agree to a pullback only if the region becomes a demilitarized zone and if the United States first provides legally watertight security guarantees. Zelensky told reporters on Wednesday that the talks on political issues, such as Russian demands for Ukraine to withdraw its forces from the east, were not easy, and that differences remain. But Zelensky also sought to put a positive spin on some of the trilateral discussions between Russia, the United States, and Ukraine in Geneva, saying they had been constructive on ways to monitor any potential ceasefire. Zelensky appealed again at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend for U.S.-backed guarantees before he signs on to any deal with Russia to end the war. Those guarantees answer the main question, how long there will be no war again, he said then. The talks between Russia and Ukraine have stalled for weeks over core differences, namely territorial concessions, control of Europe's largest nuclear power plant, which is occupied by Russia in Ukraine's Zaporizhia region, and questions about Western guarantees for Kyiv, according to two European diplomats who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive diplomacy. So far, the Russian position is no boots on the ground from NATO allies, so there are outstanding points: territory, security guarantees, and the future of the Zaporizhia plant, one of those diplomats said. Those are the big sticking points, so we need to see if it really happens. In meetings with U.S. officials late last year, Ukraine's chief European backers were encouraged by the U.S. interest in playing a role in securing a settlement to the war. France and Britain have led a coalition of allies planning ways to provide Ukraine with a U.S.-backed bulwark against future attack, including with some European troops and air or sea power. Still, the Trump administration appeared to want to sign a deal before the committing, while Kyiv has maintained it needs the Western protection baked into any settlement, the diplomat said. Russia, meanwhile, has ruled out any presence of Western soldiers in Ukraine. Zelensky, who met with Secretary of State Marco Rubio over the weekend, has stressed Kyiv's refusal to cede territorial in the east that Russia does not militarily control, and said Ukraine could only hold elections if there is a ceasefire. Analysts said it was clear the Kremlin had no intention of making any concessions. As long as Putin is in power, Russia isn't paralyzed by widespread protests, and there is at least some money left in the budget for weapons, the war will continue, said Tatiana Stanoveya, a senior fellow at Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center, in a post on X. The Kremlin will not make significant concessions, even if faced with a protracted financial and economic crisis. That means there will be no final settlement either now or in the foreseeable future, Stanoveya added. Negotiations may intensify, a short-term ceasefire is possible, and documents may even be signed. But overall, this stimulation of negotiations can only lead to the stimulation of a ceasefire and the stimulation of a settlement. Russia has long been facing increasing economic pressure after the U.S. administration imposed tough new sanctions on Russia's two biggest oil companies, Rosneft and Lukoil, in October. The measures caused Russian oil revenue to plummet as Moscow was forced to accept discounts of more than $20 per barrel on its exports. Economists have warned of a non-payment crisis as the economy grinds to a halt amid high inflation and high interest rates of 15.5% imposed by the central bank. Analysts say there are concerns in the Kremlin that Moscow could face a narrowing window to reach an advantageous deal because the Trump administration could grow distracted as midterm elections near, and then potentially could be weakened by the results. Bashir is latest 2028 contender to write a book focused on faith. Kentucky Governor Andy Bashir plans to publish his first book this fall, joining a slew of potential Democratic presidential candidates, releasing memoirs that could set up future national campaigns. The book, set to publish September 22nd, will focus on Bashir's Christian faith, a topic he often brings up amid Democrats' debates about how to broaden their appeal and take back power. As a two-term Democratic governor in a state that President Donald Trump won in 2024 by more than 30 points, he says he is proof that his party can win over skeptics by better explaining their values, and he often cites the Bible to explain his own. "My why is my faith," the governor said repeatedly last year on a tour of South Carolina, a Bible Belt state that plays an outside role in Democrats' presidential nominating process, and where potential 2028 candidates, including California Governor Gavin Newsom, are already making overtures. Republicans have often put more emphasis on religion than Democrats have, and Trump campaigned in 2024 in part on calls to make America pray again and promote Christianity. Some Democrats have worked to center their faith and push back on the GOP's message that it is part of the Christian values. Bashir will share what his own faith has meant to him, how it has informed his family and his public life, and serves as a rebuke to how faith has been hijacked, profaned, misused, and corrupted by Donald Trump and other public figures. Bashir's publisher, St. Martin's Publishing Group, said in a statement, "By regrounding faith in compassion and kindness, he believes we can start to heal as a country," the publisher added. The title of the book, "Go and Do Likewise, How We Heal a Broken Country," alludes to the biblical story of the Good Samaritan, who helps a stranger. After relating the story, Jesus urges his followers to do the same. Bashir and his wife serve as deacons at their church. Bashir is one of many ambitious Democrats who have released or plan to release books that could lay the groundwork for a national campaign. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro published a book last month, while California Governor Gavin Newsom's memoir is set to come out next week. Former Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris published her explosive memoir on the 2024 race in September. Some of those books have led to infighting among Democrats. Harris's account of vetting Shapiro as a potential vice presidential pick, for instance, drew pushback from the Pennsylvania governor, who later detailed the encounter in his own book. Bashir has drawn national attention with his victories in deep red Kentucky. The son of a former governor, he bucked the state's rightward shift to win a second term in 2023, and has encouraged Democrats to focus on kitchen table issues. At the same time, he has argued that Democrats do not need to avoid hot-button social issues. On his South Carolina tour, he said he's a proud pro-LGBTQ plus governor and used his faith to explain his position to voters. During that tour, he recounted how, after he vetoed restrictions on transgender rights, a man walked up to him and said, "Governor, I'm not sure I agree with you what you did yesterday, but I know you're doing what you think that is right, and I support you." I said, "My faith teaches me that all children are children of God, and I don't want people picking on those kids," Bashir said. And we will end today's reading with opinion from George F. Will. The 2020 stolen election obsession. Cynical, delusional, reptilian? Asked what she thought of an attack on the poet Lord Byron's morals, a wit replied, "It is the first time I ever heard of them." You might say the same if asked what you think about proofs that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. Donald Trump's belief in widespread fraud is the casting and counting of 2020 ballots is entailed by his belief that it is theoretically impossible for him to lose at anything. His certitude infects millions of Americans, some of whom think it is inconceivable that he could ever be mistaken. Others doubt that anyone could win the presidency while obsessing about a complex conspiracy for which there is no evidence. Remember, however, the aftermath of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy? Many people reluctant to believe that immense consequences could result from an insignificant person concluded that the complete absence of evidence of the conspiracy was conclusive evidence of how vast and competent the conspiracy to kill Kennedy had been. The 2020 election's contribution to humanity's history of gullibility continues through Sidney Powell, a former Trump post-election lawyer. 5 days after the election, she appeared on Fox News to say there had been massive and coordinated malfeasance to delegitimize and destroy Trump votes and manufacture votes for Joe Biden. She spoke of a computer system and Dominion voting machines, flipping votes or manufacturing them. Dominion sued Fox News and collected $787.5 million. Now Powell is defending herself against a defamation suit involving another voting technology company. Powell is merely a curiosity, an exotic, even by today's standards, flavor of paranoia, or cynicism, or both. Tulsi Gabbard, however, is important. She is director of national intelligence. In her spare time, of which she evidently has too much, she is a sleuth who last month appeared at a warehouse in Fulton County, Georgia. There, the FBI, which surely has better things to do, seized ballots from 2020. Gabbard was there to do nothing proper. Writing for the Dispatch, Kevin Carroll, senior counsel to the Homeland Security Secretary during the first Trump administration, says the National Security Act of 1947, which established the CIA, was passed by a reluctant Congress only after it was amended to stipulate that the agency shall have no police, subpoena, or law enforcement powers, or internal security functions. Carroll says the entire intelligence community is prohibited from collecting information on U.S. persons solely to monitor First Amendment-protected activity, such as voting. An executive order, updated since Ronald Reagan issued it, prohibits all elements of the intelligence community, other than the FBI, from acquiring information concerning the domestic activities of Americans. A particularly sinister aspect of Richard Nixon's behavior in the wake of the Watergate break-in was his attempt to draw the CIA into the subsequent cover-up by claiming there was a national security dimension to the matter. The Trump administration has offered no intelligible national security rationale for Gabbard's Georgia grandstanding. The FBI was there to placate the president, who in January said he should have ordered the National Guard to seize ballot boxes in 2020 swing states, presumably not in any he won. This spoken regret was followed by his wish that congressional Republicans would nationalize elections. Hours after the FBI's Georgia stunt, Trump posted some conspiracy theories, including, speaking of the exotic, this: China coordinated the use of Italian military satellites to cause U.S. voting machines to flip Trump votes to Biden. Someone should read to him Lost, Not Stolen, a 2022 report by 8 conservatives, 2 former Republican senators, 3 former federal appellate judges, a former Republican solicitor general, and 2 Republican election law specialists. They examined all 187 counts in the 64 court challenges filed in multiple states by Trump and his supporters. 20 cases were dismissed before hearings on their merits. 14 were voluntarily dismissed by Trump and his supporters before hearings. Of the 30 that reached hearings on the merits, Trump's side prevailed in only one, Pennsylvania, involving far too few votes to change the state's result. Trump's batting average, 0.016. In Arizona, the most exhaustively scrutinized state, a private firm selected by Trump's advocates confirmed Trump's loss, finding 99 additional Biden votes and 261 fewer Trump votes. It would be reassuring to think that Trump believes nothing he says about 2020. Cynicism in the presidency is less disturbing than delusion. But reassurance is not plausible. As the poet William Blake wrote, the man who never alters his opinion is like standing water and breathes reptiles of the mind. I thank you for listening to today's edition of The Washington Post, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of your day.